Today's program was brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm in Vermont, a producer of award-winning handmade cheese from goat and cow milk. For more information, visit considerbardwellfarm.com.
I'm Erica White, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Kathy Irway, the host of Eat Your Words and Heritage Radio Network. This summer, I'm taking a little break and having co-host Talia Ralph and Brianna Kurtz host several episodes. I'll see you back in the fall.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Act One, Dead Ringer. We start today with a story of physical resemblance, not of a person, but of a food.
A quick warning that if you're squeamish or averse to graphic images of food, there's going to be some of that in this report.
Here's Ben Calhoun.
I first heard about this whole thing in an email. It came from a listener, a woman.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Talia Ralph, and that clip you just heard, you have probably realized, was not me. It was Ira Glass, the host of NPR's This American Life, introducing a piece by producer Ben Calhoun, who we're lucky enough to have here in the Heritage Radio studios with us today. Ben is a longtime public radio reporter who has contributed to Radiolab, NPR, BBC, Marketplace, and covered politics for WEBZ Chicago's news desk for 8 years. His story, Dead Ringer, which Ira was just introducing in that clip, is an investigative tour de force about how hog rectum was being passed off as calamari. He actually won a 2014 James Beard Award for Best Radio Show Audio Webcast. So, Ben, thank you for being here to talk pig bung and food journalism with
My
us
pleasure.
Today. So this story, Dead Ringer, came to you as a tip from a listener, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you get a lot of those, and I'm wondering how you felt when this came across your desk. What was your first impression, and what did you think? What did you think when you got that email?
It actually came to a different producer, and she just laid out the premise. Like, she was like, just the initial anecdote of, there's a guy who says he knows someone who works in a hog processing plant, and there was a box that he said was artificial calamari, and he's like, what's artificial calamari? And the guy was like, well, hog bung. And she was like, and you know, if you picture the ring, and it was like everybody was sold. Everybody was just sold on the idea of it's just funny. It's just so we sort of decided right away somebody's got to look into it. Like, somebody should go and find out whether that's actually happening. And she was originally going to do it. Sarah Koenig, one of the other producers on the show. But she ended up tied up with other things. And somebody said, oh, do you want to do the hog rectum thing? And I was like, I absolutely do. Like, give that story to me.
Right. I mean, and was this your first food reporting effort? I mean,
yeah.
This is the first and a good one. And I always wonder, I did a story last summer, actually, that was about naked photos being sent online. And I talked to a lot of very smart and accomplished people, but I always had a hard time saying the words, like, dick pics, basically. And so I'm wondering what it was like for you doing these interviews and asking these questions. I mean, it's a really serious story about sort of food fraud and how we know or don't know where our food comes from. What was it like for you talking about it? Because it is sort of a silly and graphic topic.
Yeah, it's weird because I feel like the actual crux of it is super serious. It's like whether people are eating things that they don't think are those things, and there ends up being a whole line of reporting about seafood fraud and how often the fish you order is not the fish that you get. But like, it was weird because the emotion that laid on top of that is just, it's just so playful, and it's such a funny idea that I think that part of what ended up being a lot of my energy in making the piece was just figuring out how to balance those two things, how to take the thing seriously that needed to be taken seriously, but also dealing with the, just like, food is so emotional. And in this particular case, it creates a fun little, you know, storyline about, you know, the role that pork bung is playing. So.
For sure. Yes, the absurdity, but also the seriousness. You cite in the story that Oceana study about fish mislabeling, which is,
you know. Oh yeah, thank goodness for them. They were just like, I was like, I have to find out how much of this is happening. I was like, oh, somebody did it.
Yeah, thank God. Good work, Oceana. But also, I mean, of course, there was the horse meat scandal in Europe. Mm. And we do have these things throughout the food world of stuff not being what people say it was. Over the course of your reporting, I mean, were you shocked to find out how often this is happening as someone who doesn't cover this beat? And did you find any, like, in your reporting, any other instances of this going on? What was your reaction to the phenomenon?
No, I mean, I didn't go super far down that rabbit hole. Like, once I knew that, like, seafood fraud was possible and was prevalent, I was sort of like, okay, you know, that creates enough of a premise, at least in the context of what I'm doing. So yeah, no, it just, like, it sort of stopped, right? Maybe that's irresponsible, but I was just like,
you're like, this is enough.
Yeah, I was like it happens, good enough. That was, yeah,
for sure. And I'm wondering what your reporting process was like in the piece. I mean, the arc is interesting and we'll definitely get into that, but it seems like you hit a lot of dead ends. You had a lot of people who weren't necessarily confirming it for you, but weren't ruling it out either.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Was that frustrating? And how did you sort of get around it? What was the, you know?
It was, I mean, that's what I like. I feel like as a reporter, I like finding all of the paths to go down and then chasing them down as far as they possibly go. And in the end, I felt like it's what turned, like, at some point, I was actually, like, I was getting ready in the morning. I was, like, brushing my teeth and I was like, why am I so invested in the idea that this is possible? And I realized that through the course of all these dead ends, like, this food entity was taking on this super emotional character for me in sort of like the scape of this narrative and in looking into this idea. And that I was, that I wanted it to be true. Like, I wanted this to be possible because I felt like, in the same way that I think other kinds of foods are sort of like certain kinds of foods are like, can have like emotional qualities. Like, they're kind of like bullies or they're like, you know, comforting presences. Like, I really felt like pork rectum in this situation was like an underdog. It was like Ducky in the John Hughes movie where you're just like, oh, go Ducky, go.
You equated at one point of the piece to like Pretty Woman and Good Will Hunting, like all of these really classic underdog stories.
Yeah, it was my hero. It became my hero. I was like, that is the hero of my story.
How did that come about? I mean, that to me, I don't know that I would have had that reaction reporting that story. What was the shift for you, or why did it take on this emotional quality that you're talking about of you were rooting for it? Because really, if it was true, it means a lot of really...
I think it was just like stewing in the reporting that you're talking about for long enough and hitting all the dead ends and realizing, I mean, the ultimate reality is that, you know, it could be happening because we taste tested it and you can't tell the difference. But if it's happening, it's probably happening elsewhere. Like, and I've actually seen subsequently instances of in Chinese food of things being, you know, on a menu as pork intestines, but then in parentheses, or as being squid, but then in parentheses being pork intestines. So I'm like, oh, it could be happening somewhere. But that was really, like, it ended up because there was so much. My ultimate answer is in the U.S., like, my answer is probably not. It's indefinite, though. Like, you could do it. Like, it was sort of this squishy thing, but I was still having this really strong emotion of, I sort of hope that this is true for the character of Hog Rectum.
So the inanimate food object took on this sort of, yeah, heroic quality. And you play it up in the story, which is really fun as a listener, you know, with the music and these comparisons you're making. I'm wondering if you have any issue with food mislabeling, like if on some level food mislabeling makes you uncomfortable, or in this instance, maybe it doesn't, but thinking about others, it does. Like, did you have an opinion shift or develop in terms of the actual issue at hand?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have, it's interesting because there was a question about how to handle that in the writing of the story. And I think that people end up walking away in a lot of cases. I realize this from the response, with the wrong idea. Like they're like terrified by this idea, and I'm terrified for certain people. I think that if people have objections to eating, you know, eating pork, or if they have objections to just the idea of eating hog bung, like, I think it's unethical for people to be duped into thinking that something else, that it's something else, and then eating it for because people are being misleading. But there became a question of just like, you know, that being established, like, What's the storyline of this? And I thought that we underscored the first part of that enough in the story, but you know, I definitely, in retrospect, I wonder if we did. I could see an argument that we did, and that, you know, another argument that we didn't make it clear enough.
Clear enough what, like, the underlying serious
issues? Yeah, just issues. The severity of it. Yeah.
Right. What was the reaction? I mean, when it came out, what was the bulk of what you heard?
It was so divided. I've never done a story that was so divisive. I mean, even within, I've got friends who are at NPR in DC, and they're like, within the building, there are people who are just like, best story ever done. Like, they're just like, they're like,
that's cool.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh my gosh. Like, and then there are other people who are like, that is the hugest waste of time that has ever taken up like minutes on public radio. So yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of audience, I mean, did you see people come down more on one side or hung up on a certain aspect of it than others? Like, what was the listener reaction?
The listener reaction was kind of along the same lines. Like, some people found it to be really frivolous and, you know, just insubstantial. I can see where somebody would make that argument, but I feel like those people aren't interested in fun.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you obviously won a James Beard Award for this story, but this was your first food reporting story. Your background is more in politics and obviously This American Life, which is not predominantly a food show. What was your reaction? What was the experience of sort of being included with a lot of people whose primary focus is covering food? Oh my gosh,
shock and like a deep sense of honor. Like I was just... And it's funny, within the office, you know, there's sort of like award season and everybody's sending out their stuff and blah, blah, blah. And our office manager was like, I know we're like applying for like the Peabody and like the, you know, the DuPonts and stuff like that. She's like, but this is the one that I want. This is the one. And I think it's because, you know, I mean, people have, like, we're an office of people that love food. So it became, you know, like this rare shot for somebody from our show to actually like keep company with the folks who, you know, made up that award ceremony. So that was really, it was so fun. It was so fun. They so know how to party better than public radio. It's like, oh my gosh.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, that's how we met at a great James Beard party, and they're the food. Yeah. I mean, you got to have great food at a food award party, right? So
yeah,
we will take that compliment. The food world will, we're glad that we can throw a good,
yeah, oh my gosh, people are just like handing out like delicious drinks and like food, and like it wasn't like, oh, there's this hired caterer who's like, you know, got a few things, you can go over there and get some of that. It was just like, oh my gosh, like this is delicious, and this is also delicious, and that is delicious, and that is delicious.
Yes. I had nothing to do with this, but I'll take it on behalf of the party
of the greater community.
James Beard Awards. We'll pass that message along. We're going to take a break in just a second, but sort of going off this this interesting question of food journalism, and, you know, I don't know that I would even call This American Life or public radio mainstream journalism, but did you see in your sort of either your reporting or post, you know, being in the award ceremony and meeting other food journalists, I mean, do you see differences there between food journalism and maybe political journalism or public radio, like more news oriented journalism? Because I, sometimes food gets relegated in a certain column, you know, you see it in lifestyle or you mm-hmm. see it in business. It doesn't have its own place. And I'm wondering sort of like what your experience was being reporting a food story, not as a food reporter, and where you see that sort of relationship.
I mean, I think what you're saying is very, very true, but I feel like it's changing, and it's changing for good reason and kind of moving in the right direction. I think that, you know, I mean, food in a lot of ways is especially in American culture, something that very often is treated in I think, a pretty thoughtless way. But I think in popular culture, like, I mean, obviously, like, I mean, the fact that we're sitting in the studio where, like, people just talk about food is, I feel like there's a recognition of, you know, the importance of food, like how we nourish ourselves, what it means about for our communities and our culture, the politics of it, the economics of it, like just like all of these rich dimensions where, you know, the tensions that are at the heart of that are going to end up being the same sort of, you know, important questions that people who are reporting on a city council or like, you know, the, you know, any sort of event, like really newsy event, it ties into the same big stakes, I think. And that's also just fun. It's like, it's also just really fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we all do it. It is an interesting interplay. I think you get that interplay in a lot of stories, and especially this American Life story is sort of that pull between the serious and playful, or sort of something not necessarily being what you expect. And it was very clear in your story. We're going to take a super quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're talking to This American Life producer and James Beard Award winner Ben Calhoun here on Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Boy Crazy by Cookies on Heritage Radio Network.
She's dancing by herself in a mother's summer dress. Oh, kid, she doesn't need your help. Studied art in Spain, tall boys across her brain. Yeah, tall boys, men, they'll do anything. They sat her in the shade, threw her a parade. All lined up, marching back and forth all day. She's boy crazy. She's boy crazy. Oh, she's boy.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Talia Ralph, and you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we are lucky enough to have Ben Calhoun in the studio with us, talking about his story, Dead Ringer, about hog bunk being used as imitation calamari. Thanks for being here, Ben.
My pleasure.
So I know that you do a taste test over the course of your story to sort of determine the validity of this switch. Uh-huh. And I know that one of your taste testers who grew up Italian-American eating a lot of calamari was super horrified and sort of this definitely, I would assume, changed his mind. Have you changed your eating habits at all, or sort of thought more about, you know, when you're sitting down to a meal, what it might actually be?
No.
Are you still eating calamari?
Well, actually, I mean, this is something that we didn't put in the story, but like I've eaten my share of calamari. Like I know calamari, but like before I did this story, I developed a shellfish allergy. And so I can't eat calamari anymore. So I didn't like, I couldn't, I couldn't eat the calamari that was on the plate. Like I had to only eat the hog bung, which I feel bad about. I feel bad about saying, but like, yeah, I mean, it was like one of the reasons that we needed the taste test, and we needed the taste test really because the reporting got to, you know, as you were saying, sort of an unsatisfying end of like, it could be happening, probably not here, maybe not here, might be happening here, could be happening here, but probably not, maybe somewhere else. Like, it was just sort of this, like, wishy-washy place. So it was just, like, we needed a verdict, and it was like, a way of getting to, could this happen? Like, in a really tangible way on the radio. So we set up the taste test, and I needed the other people on the staff who could eat both things, you know. I mean, if I eat calamari, I'm up all night just, like, booting. So it's not, yeah.
So you were like the mad scientist and you subjected your fellow radio journalists.
I did eat the bung though. I ate the bung. Okay. Yeah. It tasted like I remember calamari tasting.
So you could in theory continue to enjoy.
I could.
Calamari like.
Substitute calamari. Right. Yeah, I could. Yeah.
So for people like you, it's actually sort of a boon in a way, right?
Yeah. You really got to go out of your way to want to make that though. It's right.
And Lauren, your sister, who's actually a chef here at Roberta's Pizza, she helped you prepare it in the story, which was probably nice to have a chef sibling on hand. But
oh my gosh. Yeah. She's like my secret weapon.
Is that a bonding experience for you guys? Do you cook together often? I mean.
Oh yeah. We cook together a lot. Yeah. It's so fun. We've always cooked together as a family. We used to cook with our mom. But like, especially now, like we both live here in New York and cooking meals with her, it's just like having like, just like a ninja, like 2 feet away where if something is going wrong, she's like, oh no, let me fix that for you. You just have to, and like, before you know it, everything is going fine again. Yes. So yeah, but it, in terms of the story, like knowing how to like go about the taste test in a way that would create like a realistic parallel, and you know, like if you were going to do it, thinking about the things you'd have to do with the bung that would make it resemble calamari. Like she had very specific thoughts right away about how to go about it. Right. So, yeah.
Can you get into sort of the taste test portion of the story? It's one of my favorites. I think it's just, I mean, it sounds great and it's very suspenseful to listen to. I mean, you're in the kitchen with them, you're talking to sort of your tasters who are anticipating trying to figure out what's what. It's like a very tense moment. But can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of like where you did it? What were some of the things she did to sort of equate these two different substances? Like what were some of the things that jumped out?
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of strategic butchery of the bung, in that like if you ever see a picture of one, like they are very substantial, like sort of at the bottom end, and then they like taper off, and there was like a region kind of in the middle where you get to like the width and just like the size that you would want if you were like, oh yeah, calamari. That looks like a calamari ring. But then, we were worried about that because once you floured them in the way that you would with calamari, like squid always sort of retains that sort of springy sort of, you know, natural, nice round O. Mm-hmm. But the bung, once you floured it, it just like took on this like tangled, it looks like a ball of yarn. And then it was amazing that the heat of the fryer, it was just like if it made a sound, it would have been the sound on cartoons when something goes boing. It's like they just like snapped into these rings. It was like, it was magical. And I was like, oh, I just like it might work. Like this is possible. It was like, I like if Bung was my Rocky, like he was on the ropes at that moment. Like he was about to go down. And then it was just like, he just like came out swinging.
Right. And was that the moment like reporting wise for you? I mean, probably something you never thought you would do in your journalism career is like be in a kitchen watching hog bung.
Yeah, no, fried, I always imagined that day would say, no, yeah, no.
Was that the moment where you were like, wow, this story is coming together? Or were there moments before that when you saw that snap into place? Did it snap the story into place for you?
I think there were a couple moments. That was definitely one where I was like we have passed into the threshold of victory. Like earlier, I felt like just getting at the emotions of the whole possibility of it, like, and realizing that I had a real thought and emotion about whether this might be happening, like, that was another point where it was just sort of like, oh, I think I've got a thing to say here. Like, I think I've got a thing to tell. Mm-hmm. So there were a few different, like, yeah.
Right, and one of those things must have been the fact that hog rectum is half the price of squid, right? I mean...
Oh, yeah.
Purely from an economic perspective and generally in these sort of, like, food substitutions, things not being what we think they are, economics has a hefty role to play. I mean, do you think that that is indicative of a bigger issue in our food system? Like, is food too cheap or priced strangely? I mean, it's kind of insane.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the prices are really deceptive and I think that, like, pricing in American food culture ends up obscuring so many other things that are happening with those foods. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in terms of this story in particular, the fact that it ended up feeling like it wasn't like a smoking gun, but it was like a fingerprint. Like, you'd found a fingerprint where you felt like, oh, like, yeah, there's some suspicions here. And a dynamic that in any number of things that people would buy, you wouldn't even, like, I don't feel like people do that calculus a lot of, like, what does it mean that this is cheaper or that that is more expensive? And what are all the implications across the system that's providing this thing to me?
For sure. And I mean, was that part of your goal of the story? I mean, did you go into the story with a goal, or was it just like, wow, this is kind of crazy and amusing, and you get that email and yeah, your spidey senses are tingling, you want to figure it out. But did you go into the story with a goal or several goals in mind of things you wanted to illuminate? Or
yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons I liked it so much was it appealed to different parts of my personality as, like, a journalist and as, like, a person who likes to make radio. I definitely bring, I think, like, my instincts as a reporter to any story, and this one was exactly the same in that way. But also, I mean, it's so fun. Just, like, the idea. I still, like, I love the idea of it. Like, it feels like if it wasn't, if you didn't have to use the word rectum, it could be a children's book.
If only. Yeah. If only it was a different shaped thing, we could, yeah, kids everywhere could be learning about food safety and mislabeling. And
yeah.
Maybe one day.
Yeah. A little bung that could. It's just like, yeah.
That, I like that. That has a certain ring to it. I don't know. Keep it on the back burner, right? So, I mean, we talked a little bit about the reaction, both of the taste testers, sort of the larger audience of people that were listening to this. But do you have any advice, sort of stuff you learned over the course of reporting for people who are walking away from this sort of shocked and horrified? And you know, did you come up with anything to say to people when they were asking you about this story in, like, that camp of being like, I can't believe this is happening. This has serious implications for the way I eat.
Oh, or, yeah. I mean, I would tell people, like, if you eat calamari in the United States, like, this, like, I cannot guarantee anything. But, like, I would bet everything that I own, like, I would bet, like, I have very little doubt that this is not, like, you are not eating hog rectum. Like, I don't think that it's actually happening. I think that the effort that would have to be gone through in terms of kitchens and, like, it showed me that, like, what would, like, the mechanics of actually pulling this off wouldn't necessarily be worth it in any sort of, like, scalable way. And the potential scandal of it coming out would just, like, demolish any restaurant or business or franchise. So, like, I don't think that it's happening. And so I feel like that is the thing that maybe I should have underscored a little more for people, because I think that the story pulled people into the emotions of everything that was going on. So they couldn't necessarily hear, like, there's a very distinct line, like, I do not believe this is happening later in the story, but I would hope that people would take away, like, the understanding that probably not. Like, eat your calamari with confidence.
Right, and I mean, part of it is, there's an interesting question in there, too, of, like, what is acceptable to us as Americans or North Americans or certain populations to eat versus what is commonly eaten or understood. And there's an interesting and sort of tense point in the story at which one of your sources accuses you of being racist because you're looking into it in terms of Chinese production and whether
he was
that,
so mad.
Yeah, I mean, what was that like for you? You are half Chinese, one.
Yeah.
But aside, you know, aside from the point you raise in the story, and I think it's a valid point that we should be able to ask these questions, you know, and look at cultural differences without being slammed as racist or ignorant and
yeah. I mean, I think that there's like a more honest conversation to have than the one that he was having, and he was bringing a lot of like assumptions and a huge like paradigm to his feeling that I was being discriminatory. Like, I feel like there's just like a frank conversation people can have about who eats what, and I mean, the fact of the matter is that in the U.S. people are already eating bung. Like, they just don't think consciously enough about, you know, the logistics of the food that they actually eat. Like, if they eat sausage, they're eating intestines, and like, they're eating bung. If they're eating summer sausage, they're eating beef bung. Like, there's like all of these things, you know, that we bring these sort of immediate emotional responses to, oftentimes in terms of like their place in the actual food world isn't quite what people assume that it is. But yeah, that was an entertaining moment when he was like a like this older white guy, and he was like, "You are being racist against Asians. I will tell you, you are racist. Like, this is racist. Your story
You're like,
is racist."
Yeah,
I love my mother. Like, I eat a lot of awful, like, you know, like, and I eat a lot of Chinese food that, like, I've been on the end of the thing that you're talking about, and like, I don't think I'm perpetrating that right. thing.
I think we're all the better for it that you sort of followed the thread of this story. Do you have your ear to the ground more in terms of other food stories, or was this the first and last food piece that we'll see from you? Or
I don't. There aren't any on the roster. I mean, I did a story about foie gras a while ago with the people from Stonehill, Blue Hill Farms.
Blue Hill Farms.
Yeah. But it's not like, but I would, that's not to say that I wouldn't, like, I would love to. I mean, if your reporting can involve eating and researching food, I feel like bonus.
Why not? Well, thank you so much for unpacking this food reporting with us, Ben.
Thanks for having me on. That was
fun.
This
has been another amazing episode of Eat Your Words. It's actually my last as co-host of the show. My lovely counterpart, Brianna Kurtz, will join us next week and through the end of the summer, bringing you more great words about food. And then we'll have Kathy Irway back with us in the fall. It's been a privilege and a pleasure sitting in the host chair this summer at Heritage Radio. So thank you so much to the listeners for tuning in to this episode, and always our sponsors, our talented engineer Jack Inslee, and of course This American Life's Ben Calhoun, an amazing final guest. If you haven't heard it yet, Ben's story appears on This American Life's Doppelganger episode, available online and through iTunes, and it's well worth a listen. So we'll see you guys all soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.